Oh, all right. Are we on recording?
Yeah.
Okay, today is November 15, 2010, meeting of the staff of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, interview with Vice Chairman Janet Yellen of the Federal Reserve Board. And if we can all go around the room so that our voices are identifiable for the people listening to the transcription or to the recording. My name is Tom Stanton from the research staff of the commission.
I'm Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing team.
Julie Marcacci, investigator.
Dave Caperton, board legal.
Janet Yellen, vice chair.
Scott Alvarez, board legal.
Joel Miller, FCIC research team.
Milana Vickers from the writing team, the FCIC.
And is it all right with you, Governor Yellen, if we record?
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
Thank you. Joel, do you want to put the ground rules on the record, please?
Okay. Just by way of background, as you're probably aware, the FCIC was chartered by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And what we'd like to have this morning is a discussion with you, get your views on some of the causes and events of the financial crisis. It is being recorded with your consent. The recordings, the commission will end in early February. Our report is due December 15th. And the tape will become part of the records of the commission, presumably available through the National Archives, pursuant to agreements reached between the FCIC and Scott Alvarez here at the Board of Governors.
That's good.
I'm trying to think what I missed here.
Subject to the confidentiality agreement.
Subject to the confidentiality agreement. Yeah,
exactly.
That's great.
Great. We usually begin with a very quick summary of background, if we might, for the record.
Okay.
If you could just tell us a bit about your PhD and where you went from there down to today.
Oh, all the way back to PhD. Okay. I received my PhD in economics at Yale in 1971, and my career after that was that I was an assistant professor at Harvard through the end of 1976. I joined the staff of the International Finance Division of the Board of Governors here in the end of 1976 and stayed here until the summer of 1978 when I moved to the London School of Economics and became a lecturer there for 2 years. Then was appointed an assistant professor at Berkeley in the business school starting in 1980. And I continued to rise through the ranks at Berkeley, becoming a professor. In 1994, President Clinton asked me if I would be interested in serving as a governor of the Federal Reserve, which indeed I was very interested in doing, and I was confirmed by the Senate and became a governor in 1994. When President Clinton was reelected in 1996, in the beginning of his second term in 1997, he asked me to move to the White House to chair the Council of Economic Advisors, which I didn't through the summer of 1999, and then left and went back to Berkeley and rejoined the faculty. In 2004, I was offered an opportunity to become president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, and I served in that capacity from roughly June of 2004 until I was confirmed to the position of vice chair after President Obama nominated me as vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board. So I think I'm into about four weeks okay. On the job here.
Thank you. Great. If we can go to your time at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco.
Sure.
Because 2004 is a good period to start with.
Sure.
When did you first notice that things were unusual in the markets? And I want to play off of your October speech in Denver. When and when did you first notice things were questionable in the markets? And second, when did you think things were questionable in the markets that might not be self-correcting?
I mean, certainly I felt when I got to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco in 2004 that we were in the middle of a housing boom. We were recovering from a recession. Certainly house prices were rising rapidly. I don't think at that time I was tremendously worried about horrible financial market repercussions. But my supervisory staff in San Francisco during that year, I can't remember if it was when I first got there, but sometime in 2004, was certainly beginning to worry about subprime lending and residential lending. And we had an internal publication, was for supervisory staff and also for the banks that we supervised and banks in the West concerning banking risks in our district. And this publication was in 2004 noting concern about risky practices, high loan-to-value ratios, cash-out refinancing, concerns that house price appreciation might not be sustainable, and there were concerns that were being raised about subprime borrowers and their vulnerability. Now, I can't say the concerns reach the level that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I think they should have, but certainly there were concerns that were being raised and discussed with banks in the region and banks that we supervised. I have to say that a major concern of the supervisors in San Francisco when I first joined and before that was commercial real estate. So, you know, we supervised in 2004 a couple of very large residential lenders, namely Countrywide and Wells Fargo. But the vast bulk of the institutions we supervised were smaller state member banks with very heavy concentrations in commercial real estate and a lot of vulnerability. And, you know, when I think about what was the main overriding concern of our supervisory risk group, they were really focused on commercial real estate. So I heard a great deal, many briefings about commercial real estate. I would say less about residential mortgage lending, but they certainly were beginning to sound warning bells. By 2005, I was becoming concerned personally that there was a bubble in the housing market. And I used the opportunity of my own speech making to warn about soaring house prices. And I was raising concerns about national economic stability and potential vulnerability to a decline in house prices. We had had a long debate within the Fed and outside about what the role of monetary policy should be or should not be in addressing bubbles. And I would say that I certainly at that time, and my views are gradually changing on this, but at the time I was pretty much in the camp. It's not that I thought bubbles in asset markets cannot pose risks to the economy. I certainly thought they could. But I felt, and in a way I continue to feel, that supervision and regulation are the appropriate first line of attack. And beginning in 2005, I was giving speeches in which I suggested there might be a problem, and I saw that as the main thing that was needed to address repercussions that could ensue from a decline in house prices. Our examiners at this point were also intensifying their focus on residential mortgage practices and the supervision we were doing. They were worried about underwriting risk controls around mortgage-related activity and subprime origination. And we were doing exam work relating to policies around predatory lending practices, whether or not that underwriting practices included documented benefits to borrowers. We were looking at whether or not underwriting models complied with the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and fair housing requirements. And at this point, we were discussing with our colleagues here in Washington our concerns about these practices. And ultimately, of course, we had guidance that was issued on non-traditional mortgages.
But you led the guidance. You were ahead of the guidance, is what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say that we were, in our discussions with our colleagues here in Washington, indicating that we were concerned about what we saw happening in terms of underwriting practices and vulnerabilities and, pushing for supervisory guidance to be issued that would enable our examiners to take a tougher line on some of these practices.
Well, that was really the question, whether your examiners were equipped, given your concerns, to take a tougher line than the existing guidance.
I think basically the answer is no. I think that we would have needed to go into a particular institution and impose standards that were tougher than were generally being applied by the Fed and other regulators throughout the industry, to use somehow the discretion in San Francisco to say, nope, we're going to do something that's not justified by broad guidance to examiners. I mean, I can't say that I ever had this discussion, explicitly asked this question to our supervisors, but I think we felt that we, in San Francisco, supervision is a delegated activity, and we operate under the guidelines on supervision that are given to us by the Board of Governors, and those guidelines in turn are typically negotiated through interagency FFIEC processes. So I believe the guidance that came out, it wasn't just board guidance.
That's
it,
right,
it was interagency guidance. And so in some sense it required, I think, an interagency process to issue guidance that would enable examiners throughout all of the institutions to take a tougher line on some practices we were seeing.
If I can sketch out and I'll just represent it, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. We have been told that, first of all, interagency guidance was very difficult to get because it went to the lowest common denominator, and we've heard frustration at certain aspects, for example, of non-traditional lending that were dropped from guidance because one of the agencies simply wasn't ready to sign on. We've also been told that developing guidance through an interagency process was a horrendously long process. So my question really is the extent to which examiners in a district such as yours, where you're beginning to see something significant in California, clearly was a place where one could see that. What does one do to have effective regulation, given that concatenation sort of bureaucratic activities?
I wasn't involved in the interagency process. I was sitting at San Francisco's, sort of in charge of a team that was operating under delegated authority and in touch routinely with staff here at the board. Could we, if we had insisted, done something in our own supervision in the institutions that we supervised to crack down in a way that was, in some sense, San Francisco Fed discretion? I honestly don't know if we could have done that. I don't think we felt empowered to do it. I mean, if you're asking me, is it conceivable that we could have used our own discretion to be tougher than our colleagues were in other reserve banks or controller of the currency or the Office of Thrift Supervision or what was allowed for in policy coming out of an interagency process, I don't think my supervisors felt they had the power to do that. I think they felt, and I went along with it. I mean, I didn't push it to the point I conceivably could have, but I think we felt that interagency guidance was required. On the commercial real estate side, we were very frustrated by how long it took. We were tremendously worried about commercial real estate. We had very high concentrations in our district, and we had an unusually high reliance in our banks on non-core funding for funding loans. And so we knew there was a vulnerability on the funding side and very heavy concentrations. And, of course, that's where the exposure in most of our banks was to residential. The residential sector is construction and land development lending. And so if you look at the banks that are failing in our district, almost all of them so far are exposure to construction and land development, so residential construction. Of course, there's sort of broader commercial real estate as well. But as worried as we were, you know, for example, what, with the benefit of hindsight, might we have done? Might say, well, look, it's risky to have a very high concentration in commercial real estate. We're just going to demand that you have a higher capital requirement. We're going to raise the risk weight on this. We're going to do something about concentration. And at some level, we were pleading with Washington to please do something on commercial real estate. As worried as we never simply went into banks and said, we insist you've got to have a higher capital requirement. Did we have the power to do that? I think we felt we did not. So I'm talking about we in San Francisco on an isolated basis.
Would you have given a legal opinion to that effect?
So there's a variety of powers that the Reserve Bank has. The Reserve Bank can't, for example, change the capital risk weightings for assets. That's done by rule. That's something that has to be applied the same across. Where the Reserve Bank has discretion, though, is in the findings about whether a particular institution is operating in a safe and sound manner, and they can recommend enforcement matters. They can, if they have facts that suggest somebody's acting unfairly or deceptively, they can make recommendations on enforcement matters there. They can recommend, give ratings to exams in the exam process about the strength of an organization, which depends often on the concentration and the quality of the assets and things like that, that only they are on the, able to determine because they're on the scene. So there's a wide variety of things that happen. I think as a general matter, setting the guidance and setting where the bar is something that we do as a system.
What about 12 U.S.C.? I think it's 3907 that allows the examiner to raise capital for an institution they believe is somehow operating in a risky manner.
Right.
Would a Federal Reserve Bank be able to lead the system on that?
So they would be able to make a recommendation to the board.
It would go back to the board.
Yeah. But it has to, it begins at the Reserve Bank. So it is a relationship that we manage together.
My concern is, and I will tell you this, because your discussion of rules and discretion in your speech, I mean, we just don't see enough of that from my personal perspective. My concern is that the process is a very long one.
Yes.
And that there seemed to be a dynamic possibly seen in Countrywide leaving your jurisdiction of a race to the bottom. And my question really is,
absolutely,
in retrospect, what should people do given that the examiners on the ground see real problems, be it in commercial real estate or with some of the larger institutions in subprime or Alt-A, whatever? How does one cut through that?
You know, that's why, in part, I think it becomes very difficult when you have discretion. This is what I sort of base, you know, it's this experience that has strongly inclined me toward tougher standards and built-in rules that will come kick into effect automatically when things like this happen that make tightening up a less discretionary matter, that tougher rules will go into effect automatically without requiring this kind of process that I think we have had, where it takes six different regulators in the FFIEC to negotiate in what I gather is an excruciating process over many years to do something that in the end is probably too little too late. I mean, to my mind, that process fails. I mean, in the case of commercial real estate, what ultimately came out of the guidance when it was issued was, I mean, maybe this is a caricature of it, but the way I recall what it said was, if you have a very high concentration in commercial real estate, you should make sure that your risk management processes are up to the standards of being able to manage this. And, you know, from my standpoint, if I've got a really heavy concentration in, I mean, take one of the first banks to fail that was a state member bank in California, is a bank by the name of County Bank, located in Merced, that was doing lending all in the Central Valley in one of the areas that saw the hugest housing boom and bust. And, you know, if you've got a concentration of lending to, even if it includes some businesses in the area, the entire area was the epicenter of a boom and bust, you're just not survivable. There's no way. It doesn't matter. You know, the only risk management practice that can possibly be effective is to be much more diversified than this bank was, or to have much more capital than they had to be able to withstand this risk. So I felt when this guidance came out, you could take this and rip it up and throw it in the garbage can. It wasn't a tool that was of any use to us in controlling this risk. So, you know, could we have said, and this was a perfectly well-managed bank. I mean, it's not, you mm-hmm. couldn't call them. I mean, I'm sure we were constantly saying this is a danger that you have these high concentrations. But aside from that, it was a very well-managed operation. So, yeah, I mean, that's what inclines me toward, I think we'd need much more capital. I think, you know, liquidity. I think we need built-in rules that would come into play.
I guess I'm haunted by the line in your speech that said, once we define serious rules, the people responding to those rules will simply engineer around them.
Well, that's really a concern as well. And I mean, you mentioned the case of Countrywide, and we did become pretty tough in our supervision of Countrywide. I mean, I am not going to say that we saw in that institution all the dangers that were lurking there. Did we have a thorough appreciation of the flaws in the securitization process and so forth, and the way in which they could affect the financial system as a whole, no. But we certainly saw we had the largest mortgage lender in the United States, that at a time when there was an unprecedented boom in housing prices, had an incredibly aggressive strategy to attempt to dominate the industry and grow at an exorbitantly rapid rate, pushing the envelope to try to gain dominance of this industry. And certainly around that, we were very rigorous in requiring risk management practices that would force them to ramp up very substantially what they were doing.
Could you elaborate on the point you just made? You said they didn't see how the flaws could affect the financial system as a whole. I wonder whether you can talk about that in the context of your work in San Francisco, and also in terms of Fed discussions overall. When governors were aware of risks, or you personally were aware of risks, did your mind leap to the thought that this is going to become a Wall Street issue? You know, when did you go from the underwriting risks to the risks to the securitization process and mortgage-backed products in the market?
Me, I personally, so I don't know. I don't know what people at the board thought. I was not a governor. I was a president sitting out in San Francisco. So I can't really tell you what the thinking was of the members of the board at the time. I will tell you for my own part, I did not see and did not appreciate what the risks were with securitization, the credit rating agencies, the shadow banking system, the sieves. I didn't see any of that coming until it happened. We discussed in the course of FOMC discussions potential risk to the economy that we certainly considered from what was happening in housing. My own focus in thinking about what the risks were to the economy, I kept focusing on house prices by almost any measure seemed to be substantially overvalued. I felt prior to the crisis that there was a very significant risk of a decline in house prices. Now, I have to say, when I asked myself what would be a very significant fall in house prices, to think through could the economy withstand it, the kind of number that I used was not nearly as large as what we actually suffered. I mean, I would have thought a 25% decline in house prices, that's the kind of thing I would be going through in my mind, what would happen if house prices fell 25%. Certainly in analyzing that, I thought that would have significant repercussions for the economy that would be negative and would be worrisome. But I guess I thought, similar to the collapse in the stock market around the tech bubble, that most likely the economy could withstand it and the Fed would have room to respond to support the economy in the event of a downturn, as it had following the collapse in stock prices. So I guess beyond that, in a general sort of way, I recognize that a collapse in house prices could negatively impact financial institutions and markets, because after all, there certainly were some very large institutions with huge exposure to mortgages that you could have. I mean, and already by 2006, we were seeing an increase in delinquencies and foreclosures. And so, it was clear that was a route by which the financial system could be harmed, and there could be spillovers into availability of credit that could intensify a downturn. But did I in any way see or contemplate the massive meltdown we had because of securitization, the credit rating agencies, the growth and leverage in the shadow banking system? I didn't. I'm sorry. Maybe I wish I had, but I didn't.
Oh, you're very generous in offering what you say your own limitations in the subject. I've heard many people talk about it, and not many are prepared to say there was lots I missed, and I could have done better. But let me ask you this: are there ways in which the regional feds and the Fed here institutionally could have served its own decision makers better? I'll give you an example of what I mean. You have on your website forms that you give out to financial institutions on where financial institutions have to report their counterparty risks, etc., in the derivatives market. I've had them for, don't remember when it started, maybe 04 or something. Not until this summer were the forms adjusted to have a line in the counterparty risk items that said hedge funds. Or similarly, there certainly were data available on the size of components in the credit markets. If a person were really studying credit markets and what was making them move, that person could have observed that mortgages, were a big player. So, would you agree with maybe what's coming off for me as an allegation that there was information there that could have been seen if people had been looking at certain public inputs?
I think people weren't thinking about the right questions and hadn't identified the risks that we later realized to be the most serious ones. Was there information there? Sure. I mean, there's loads of information, but you spot that information and it becomes salient to you only if you've asked the right question and are focused on an investigation that leads you to that information in a meaningful way where you can fit it into a line of thought you have. And I think we weren't thinking along the lines that if somebody had displayed this information to us, it wouldn't have sounded bells in a way that would have alerted us to what the real risks were there. We made assumptions that were undoubtedly wrong. I mean, we never really, to the best of my knowledge, certainly we in San Francisco weren't asking ourselves, what on earth are these rating agencies doing? And do we trust their ratings, or are they systematically in error for some reason? We weren't looking into that. And I have to say more broadly that we weren't really thinking that much about financial stability. Our supervision was safety and soundness supervision of institutions on an institution-by-institution basis. Our examiners were not out there trying to identify threats to the broader financial system. And, I think that under Graham Leach Bliley, we had Fed-lite limitations on the way in which we were allowed to supervise non-bank subsidiaries of financial holding companies and bank holding companies. And our focus was always in our supervision of those non-bank subsidiaries was the bank. I really think the lens through which our supervisors were doing their work was always risk to the deposit insurance funds, risk to the taxpayers that could come through the failure of an insured depository institution. And that was really, as I understand it, formally embodied in Graham Leach Bliley, that why were we in there? Why were we a holding company supervisor? Is we were supposed to be thinking about all these other entities in terms of can they explode? And if they explode, will the bank be safe? And that's what I really think that that's what our supervisors were thinking about when they were out in the field. And, you know, say, as we looked at a Countrywide, it was a huge originator of private label mortgage-backed securities, subprime securities, and so forth. It was, you know, generating product. It was packaging into these securities and selling off to investors who were carefully specifying exactly what it was they wanted. They were satisfying a demand in the market. And, you know, if I asked questions about the quality of these loans, they would say, you know, they are producing product under terms that the market wants to buy, and this is all going through credit rating agencies. And what's the main risk we should be thinking about? Well, they're warehousing these loans until they have a chance to get it off their balance sheet and sell it into the market. The safety and soundness issue from the standpoint of our supervision of the bank is that in most of the origination, almost all the origination, was not in the bank. It was in a non-bank sub, this enormous mortgage company. Why were we even supervising this entity? The only reason we were supervising this entity, it had nothing to do with the mortgage company, is because they had, in the grand scheme of things, a little bank. If they got rid of that little bank, we wouldn't have been in there at all. Mm-hmm. We were only in there because of the bank. And the question is there... they're warehousing these loans that they've not yet dumped into the market. Can those things, if they were to blow up, create a threat to the bank? And that was the lens through which we were looking at this. And so I think some of the things, if our mandate to our supervisors had been financial stability, they would have asked a set of questions about what they were seeing and sounded alarms that were, they didn't, because that wasn't really their focus when this problem was building.
Who did you assume was taking a look at financial stability?
I mean, in our role as FOMC members, we were certainly considering and debating the housing situation, foreclosures, and whether or not that could pose a risk to the economy. But somehow there was a whole level of analysis that we weren't doing in enough detail, we weren't serious enough about, and we missed a lot of things that were going on. And not all of this was going on in banks. I mean, we learned as soon as we got into the crisis that many of the problems were in the shadow banking system, and that's where the buildup of leverage was hugest. We had a huge amount of mortgage activity, subprime origination, some of the very worst practices, lending standards were taking place in companies that were not supervised at all by any federal banking regulator. And, you know, these companies were competing with the Wells Fargos and Countrywides of the world. And, of course, you did have the phenomenon that you mentioned, which is you can go regulator shopping. And, you know, in the end, Countrywide, in early 2007, switched their supervision, decided they could do very nicely with being a thrift. And so, you know, while I don't know, you'd have to interview the executives of that company to find out what they were thinking when they changed charters. I like to think that in spite of all that we may have missed, that we we were tough enough in our supervision that they decided they might prefer to be supervised by somebody else.
I'd like to go back to your speech and sort of wrap this in. Do I hear you saying that if you had been looking for the right thing, excuse me, you might have found it? In other words, your talk in Denver says we must be focusing on financial stability.
Yes.
Was that merely one of many missing ingredients, or was that sort of the essential missing ingredient, that there was nobody really charged at that point with looking at financial stability and trying to understand concatenations that might threaten it?
Throughout the financial system and not just the banking system. I think we were focused on the banking system, and I don't think we were, you know, sufficiently looking at the risks throughout the entire financial system. And I don't think that we or anyone else in the government really had a financial stability mandate. So we in the Fed, I mean, the Federal Reserve, whenever there is a financial crisis, of course becomes the entity that has to intervene to preserve financial stability. And our discount window plays a critical role. So once you have a financial meltdown, there's no question the Federal Reserve has an important responsibility. But I don't think that we were tasked, in some sense, with doing the kind of analysis of the financial sector as a whole and explicit responsibility for identifying broad risks in the financial system that, you know, for example, the new FSOC is charged with doing. Now, I think, you know, Chairman Bernanke, to his credit, when he became chair, believed, focused on this. There are many central banks that do have financial stability reports. So this is something, I mean, the IMF has a financial stability report, the Bank of England, the Central Bank of Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia, there are other central banks that have produced financial stability reports. We never had any such report, and I believe that the chairman regarded that as the direction we should go in when he became chair, that he did start efforts here to move in that direction. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for realizing that that was something we needed to take much more seriously, that we needed to do. And he got that underway before the crisis occurred. We never published financial stability reports, but there were people here working on it. But it was a young effort. And, you know, maybe if we had begun that years before and had the expertise and were focusing on it in an interdisciplinary way, and it was, you know, a more mature effort, you know, maybe we would have spotted things. But you also have to realize that, so I'm not trying to abrogate responsibility for this. I really wish we had seen and understood more than we did. But you did have the IMF, you did have the Bank of England, you had an awful lot of financial stability work going on, and nobody saw how serious this would be.
That actually states the problem. Let me represent, there will always, excuse me, there will always be a shadow banking system. Wherever the line goes, it will move. Can one, in fact, without examining all of the institutions that are relevant, their risk management practices, everything else, thanks, sorry. Can one, in fact, have any degree of reasonable confidence that simply assigning somebody to look at financial stability will send the warnings in time?
I don't feel that I can assure you that there will never be another financial crisis.
You've quoted Hyman Minsky, yes.
I've been very influenced by Hyman Minsky. You know, we won't have a repeat of the last crisis.
Right.
I mean, I, as you know from my speech, I'm hopeful we can do a better job. I feel it's critically important to try to ramp up what we do. You know, it's the next financial crisis will be something completely different. And will we have the ability to spot it? And, of course, there's always an incentive for the dangerous activity to migrate into some new spot that is not where we're looking.
Yep.
This is really hard.
Yep.
I believe we are highly motivated to do a better job, not to let anything like this happen again. And, you know, we're starting, we've announced the formation of an Office of Financial Monitoring and Stability here. Throughout the Federal Reserve System, we have really invigorated our work on how do you measure, monitor systemic risk. We have really thoughtful work, research, bringing in a bunch of very smart people to monitor growing leverage, maturity, mismatch, and other things that I think are hallmarks of growing financial instability. Mm. We're working very hard on this. We will put a lot of effort into this, not only at the board, but in a system-wide basis, and hopefully be able to work with the Financial Stability Oversight Council to do a better job. But, you know, this is really yep. hard.
Let me, if I may, go to a more micro level. The mantra with Fed Light was, we are going to have institutions, and you reflected it with the commercial real estate guidance, that know how to manage their risks. I have now interviewed people up and down the line at 9 different companies, and either companies got risk management or they didn't. It's really that simple. It's levels of the game. One of them that may have gotten it, I'd be interested in your opinion, as well as Fargo. But my question really is the extent to which a supervisor for a large complex institution is fortified to go in to an institution and say, this board is supine, this board is not challenging an overbearing CEO, to come into a large complex institution and deal with the qualitative issues. The way we've gotten the reflection is, it's easy to do compliance with the Bank Secrecy Act or general compliance reviews. You check the box, it's quantitative, everything's fine. But to what extent is a bank supervisor equipped to go to a large institution and say, I don't like the way your board is receiving risk management information?
I think we are empowered to do that. And I think we have done that. We've certainly done this in institutions that we my firsthand experience is that part of our review and supervision of institutions does have to do with corporate governance and the ways in which boards of directors are or are not performing the functions that we believe they should be performing. And this is, I mean, actually one of the things where I have less concern rather than more concern. I feel that is part of our standard checklist of what we are looking for in terms of risk management, and I think we are empowered. I, you know, certainly have met with boards of directors myself of institutions that we supervise, and when we have real concerns about a board of directors and how they're performing their functions. I mean, not only do our examiners and my head of supervision go in and meet with the board, but I go in and meet with the board myself personally. And so have we ever missed things? Undoubtedly we have, but is that well within the core of what supervision is about? I believe it is. I think we are able to do that.
Did you go in and talk to any of the troubled banks that we've come to know?
I'm sure. Which
did you go in and talk to any of the troubled institutions that we've come to know?
Which troubled institutions?
Any of the banks that created after the meltdown.
So, I mean,
I'm just looking for an example of an institution that you went into.
A large one.
Right,
yeah.
Along the way.
Okay, so I've certainly been in Wells Fargo and met with the board of directors of Wells Fargo. I mean, we supervise Union Bank. Mm-hmm. These are not institutions that have been in terrible trouble. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big ones in my district that have failed are IndyMac, WaMu, and we didn't have any supervisory role at all in any of those institutions. Mm-hmm. In smaller institutions that have failed, you know, usually it's my head of supervision who's gone to talk to a board of directors. I mean, I tend to myself go into our larger institutions. So we've had quite a few, you know, smaller state member banks or banks where we're the supervisor of the holding company. And certainly, if I haven't gone, my head of supervision has certainly been in there meeting with boards of directors to read them the Riot Act about what their responsibility is. So I don't think I'm not so concerned about that particular.
Your sense is that's a practice among the Federal Reserve banks that have major complex institutions.
Sure. Yeah, I think it is.
The second problem that we've run into is that it seems very hard for a supervisor to know the risks an institution's taking on if the institution doesn't know those risks.
That's for sure. And I mean, it's been stunning to me to discover how some large institutions have failed to understand what their own risks are.
What does one do to change that?
You know, I think one of the most important things that we're doing in supervision here to change that comes out of the work that we did with the stress test, which I think was a tremendously successful exercise and a great learning experience for us. I think especially with the largest institutions, supervising them on a so-called horizontal basis as a group, so we're taking all of them, we are collecting an interdisciplinary team here and, you know, among supervisors that is going to take all the institutions simultaneously, compare them with one another, and bring the best tools to all the institutions simultaneously to assess their risks. That's probably the best and most thorough way of understanding what the risks are in these institutions. I think when you do an institution by institution basis, so let's say in the old days pre-stress test, when I've been, say, involved in a Wells Fargo or a Countrywide, we have a team of people. They're going in and reviewing as thoroughly as they can an institution. But it's hard for them to have the skills to really push back against management. If management says, oh, this is how we've assessed, we did a stress test, and you know, we think we stand such and such a way in terms of if the unemployment rate rises, our mortgage portfolio will take such and such losses. it's hard for individual examiners to have the expertise to push back against that and question, really dig deeply into how did they do this analysis. Now, for many years, we have had specialists with expertise in some particular area, like mortgages, who will go to many of the largest institutions, because we recognize you can't have a team in San Francisco with, we have one really large institution that we supervise with the really advanced skills necessary to really take a microscope into what they're doing. And so we have had teams that have gone to many of the largest institutions, but the stress tests have taken that to a completely new level, in which now we're really assembling a team that is going to sort of assemble the best modeling techniques we have, the best empirical analysis to figure out how do you assess the credit risk in a mortgage portfolio, is going to apply it simultaneously to the 10 or 19 largest institutions and really push back against management that otherwise they've got big teams of people. How do you really know what the special characteristics of their portfolios are? And I think we're doing and will do a much better job of it.
Do you detect a bureaucratic issue of the sort of the fault line between the Federal Reserve Board and the individual banks? I will tell you that we interviewed one person who said San Francisco was just wonderful at communicating, but there were certain other Federal Reserve banks with a lot of large complex institutions under their charge that were not.
Wonder what that meant. Could be. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've heard differing reports, obviously, as you have, and I think this is a man here who probably has a better sense of this than I do. I mean, we always in San Francisco, and I appreciate your good report on us, I feel we have always felt the Board of Governors is charged with supervision, and we operate under, as far as I have been concerned, this is a delegated authority. We do our darndest to carry it out in the manner specified by the Board of Governors. If we have seen things or had actions we thought we should take, we people in San Francisco are on the phone 30 times a day consulting with people at the board to make sure we're on the same page. And I firmly felt this is a delegated function. The board is in the driver's seat. We're the eyes and ears out in the field, and we're doing the work, but we're not trying to make supervisory policy. We're trying to carry out the work that the Board of Governors has delegated to us. We've always had that view of supervision, and I just don't know what's true with the other banks. I mean, I gather there is a large bank with a lot of responsibility that's had a somewhat more independent-minded view of things, but I honestly am not in a great position to opine on that. I thought it worked fine. I mean, I thought this, the model of we're out in the field, we're a field office for you. I mean, of course, there are occasional disagreements because we're in banks, we see things, we develop an opinion, and the people sitting here, we sometimes have debates, but I think that's healthy.
Yeah.
Do you think your time here in D.C. helped inform your thinking about
Absolutely.
This? How did it help?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the board. And, I firmly believe that the policy function of the Federal Reserve in supervision and other things rests with the board. This is a full-blown government agency. There's no question in my mind that Congress has assigned responsibility to the Board of Governors to carry out these functions. And in that sense, my sense of what is the appropriate position of a reserve bank vis-a-vis the Board of Governors is, let me just say, a little more docile than some of my colleagues who, you know, somehow seem to feel, heck with Washington, we know better.
Can I ask you a technical question? I just don't know this. Do the out in the reserve banks, are you able to see the minutes of the FOMC? Can you see what they're all discussing? What do you know about their discussions here in Washington about the various issues that come up for the board?
Well, we don't have knowledge. Well, the presidents participate in the FOMC. The FOMC is involved in monetary policy.
So do you see the whole board discussion from start to finish? You're part of it. No.
For the FOMC, which is the 12 presidents and the governors on monetary policy, we're a part of it. We are sitting in.
So there's nothing that you're off.
Yeah, but we're talking here about supervision and a bunch of other things.
No.
Where
on
all these other things, those are Board of Governors matters. They're not FOMC matters. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any insight. I mean, we don't have information about what's going on.
So when the Board of Governors meet, that's the arena in which you're not privy to.
We're not involved in any Board of Governors discussions.
Okay.
So if there are discussions in the Board of Governors about supervisory issues or policy issues around supervision.
Right, though the one caveat I would, if you don't mind my interjecting, is that oftentimes guidance like the non-traditional mortgage guidance would be circulated among the staffs of the reserve banks to get their comments before it's made final.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a decision of the Board of Governors, not the presidents, as opposed to the FOMC, where the presidents all fully participate.
So, for instance, if the Board of Governors, let's just say hypothetically, they were having a discussion among themselves about securitization, would you have known that they were having that discussion, or you would not know?
No, probably not.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
I have a couple more questions. I want to hand it off to
Thanks.
Joel. The first one is the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco and your perception of the role they might have played in terms of providing funding for large mortgage lenders in California and whether that had any relationship at all to the financial crisis or was simply a funding question?
I honestly I'm not knowledgeable enough about the role of the Federal Home Loan Banks to give you a good answer to that question. I mean, certainly they're an important source of funding for the banks in our area. And you know, many of the banks have been highly reliant on them, and going into the financial crisis, they were, in a way, preferred to the discount window and highly available. But the extent to which they might have contributed to this, I don't think I can give you a good answer to that. I haven't studied that enough. I don't know.
And the very last question for me, then, to Joel. Thanks, Joel, for waiting. We've perceived that around 2005 to 2007, institutions that might have kept their credit standards and other standards suddenly had a strategic choice to join the party or not. And a large number of them did. And I'm curious your perception of the drivers of that race to the bottom. I'm not sure you saw it with Wells. I'd be interested in your perception of that. But generically, it seemed like the diminution of credit standards and so forth accelerated in that period.
I think it did, and certainly by 2007, it just seemed to me that credit standards had diminished in every area of lending. So, you know, when people describe this as a subprime crisis, you know, as important as subprime and housing was, my own perception in the months before the crisis was there was simply a frightening diminution in risk aversion throughout lending generally. And You know, certainly the spring, winter, spring, you know, preceding the 2007 summer events, I was giving speeches about, well, this is frightening, you know, basically this is frightening what's going on. I'm seeing it not just in residential lending, is evident in commercial real estate. The stories that I was hearing about lending for leverage buyouts were truly appalling. I mean, it was across the board, and it appeared to affect most institutions. I mean, when I heard from one of my contacts, I remember stories about competition among private equity firms to take a particular firm private. And one of my contacts said, we sat down in my firm, there were so many companies that were bidding crazy amounts for this company to take it private. We asked ourselves, what kind of lending package would we have to get in order to be able to make a successful bid? We wrote down what the numbers would have to look like, and when we saw the terms we would have to get on this bank loan, we just thought, it's ludicrous. There is no way we could possibly find a financial institution to lend to us on these terms. And then somebody said, well, what the hell, let's just chop it around and see what banks are willing to do. And when they found that the banks were falling all over one another to make these loans on terms that were just unbelievable, that, you know, my contacts said never in their entire careers had they ever seen such irresponsible lending. And then this firm succeeded in, you know, bidding for this high-profile company. I mean, that was terrifying to me.
And
I think this was... You know, again, a lot of these loans were going to end up being packaged into CLOs and sold off into the marketplace. And, you know, I can't speak for what happened in other places. We supervised Wells. Wells wasn't very active in this. I mean, Wells was doing quite a bit of private label securitizations. But it wasn't into any of these other activities, really. And so, you know, it wasn't the banks that were doing this were, you know, not ones we were supervising, you know, personally in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not sure. But, you know, when Chuck Prince is saying, as long as the music is playing, you have to dance, I mean, that's fundamentally what this was about. I think you're asking about Wells, and I think Wells was involved certainly in subprime lending. Mainly it was packed securitizing subprime loans. You know, it's taken some substantial losses on the mortgages that they originated and held on their balance sheet. It hasn't been immune from credit losses there and home equity lending they did. But I think they were always somewhat more conservative. They have a different culture for evaluating loans that they make. They've never been really taken with some of these VAR-type methodologies and other methodologies that banks have, you know, used to evaluate lending. They were, certainly their CEO was complaining quite a lot about deterioration in lending standards. You know, but they were exposed too. I mean, it's not as though they didn't take any hits.
Got it. Thanks. Joel, sorry, I didn't mean to take so much time. This is fascinating.
I have just a few questions. They're almost going to seem random because Tom pretty much covered the waterfront here. I want to just fill in a few gaps. So where you have a situation where you have banks that seem to be extending credit way beyond what would be normal or acceptable. While it may not have happened in your district, looking forward, how do you control that the next time? When do you stop? When do you take away the punch bowl?
Well, you know, as I said in my speech, I would really like to have much tougher standards in place. And, for example, ways of imposing capital standards that have built-in countercyclical features where we require buildup of capital buffers, for example, in good times, that can be run down in bad times. You know, I would like to see... I think it's important that we have a resolution mechanism. You know, ideas like contingent capital, possibility of bail-ins that create much more of a risk-sensitive culture in banks. I think the incentives that exist with respect to compensation schemes in banks, I think, financial institutions generally, I think that was played a very important role in the risk taking that management was, you know, had put in place incentives that really created vast opportunities for risk taking among, you know, employees of the institution. And we've put in place now new standards for compensation schemes. I'm very hopeful that that will make a positive difference in terms of controlling risk-taking in organizations. So, I mean, I'd like to see much tougher supervision.
You noted a few times that the reserve banks operate under delegated authority in terms of supervision and certainly in terms of enforcement. Do you think it would be helpful to provide the reserve banks with more autonomy in that area?
No.
Looking back on the events of the last few years, at least in your district, if you had had more autonomy, if there was a sense that you could bring an action or could sanction a bank more than Washington policy laid out, would that have been beneficial?
You know, I'm not sure. There are so many supervisors, and one has to have, in some sense, for institutions, a level playing field, especially when they can choose their supervisor and have some ability to move. We come into one institution, we supervise and say, we're really laying down the law. And none of the other supervisors of institutions that they compete with are doing comparable things. You know, it's some sense a question of equity there. And there's also a question of ability to take their business someplace else. That's not a very good system. I think it does require interagency agreement to, you know, in our discussions with other countries too. As we, you know, all try to tighten supervision and regulation, I think we recognize the importance of moving together to create a level playing field, again, to try to diminish opportunities to move from tough regulators to lax regulators.
In San Francisco or in the western part of the U.S., was there a separate body, sort of a mini FFIEC, where the banking agencies and maybe even the SEC got together periodically to discuss common issues?
I'm not sure. I mean, my supervisors in San Francisco work very closely with the OCC, the FDIC, and the states. So those contacts are daily, ongoing. But and certainly there are lots of, meetings to discuss the state of the banking system that involve all of those agencies getting together, but, you know, I'm not sure if you're thinking of something more targeted where top people get together to...
Would you have met regularly with your counterpart from OTS in the last 5-6 years?
I didn't meet with my counterpart from OTS, but I think, you know, probably top people in my bank supervision group were meeting with OTS and others.
Okay. I'm trying to understand, since OTS, as you mentioned,
yes,
had some of the, what we now know, most problematic charters, how you got that information.
I mean, I would say information sharing across agencies was, well, I will certainly say with the OTS, okay, so let me be a little more targeted here, was not very good. So, you know, we, for example, were doing discount window lending in the final days of IndyMac. Certainly we were in very close touch with the FDIC, but I would say that our relationship in terms of the amount of information we were getting, both in IndyMac case and also in WAMU, we were also involved. I mean, we had no supervisory role, but we did, you know, we did have the discount window responsibility. It was painful to try to get adequate information from OTS, and there was not a very good ability to work collegially with them.
Okay, and I want to allow some time here, so one last question. In terms of having representatives of the banking industry working with you at the Reserve Bank?
What do you mean working with us? You mean serving on our boards of directors?
Correct.
Okay, so sure, we have three bankers who are members of our boards of directors, yes.
Right. Were there issues that came up in terms of determining how to supervise banks or bring actions against banks where they would weigh in?
Absolutely not. They have absolutely nothing to do with supervision. Nothing. They play no role. They don't know anything about supervision. They have supervision is behind an iron wall vis-a-vis those directors. They have nothing to do with supervision. Okay, there are a lot of things that are wrong that need to be fixed. That is not. I know there is a perception that there can be a conflict here between having banking directors and the conduct of supervision. They had nothing to do with supervision. It would have been utterly inappropriate and never occurred that any supervisory matters were discussed with them. We might make general presentations to the whole board of directors on banking conditions in the West, that type of thing, nothing but any institution-specific thing.
Just right on that point, that we've certainly been told about that Chinese wall, even by people who play those roles, the room bankers who are in those positions. I wonder whether you would agree that maybe there was too much of a Chinese wall in terms of information from the private sector, from investment banks, from people very much engaged in securitization of mortgages, very familiar with CLOs, CDOs, credit default swaps, who could have been informing the Fed's judgment more. You know, were those channels as good as they ought to have been?
I mean, they definitely existed. And, you know, for example, the anecdote I was reporting about the private equity situation, that was certainly something that came to me, that kind of information came to me from directors of my bank. I have an economic advisory council. It includes people involved in private equity and hedge funds and so forth. So, I mean, I won't say that the information I got was as systematic and thorough as maybe we would want as we go into now a more organized financial stability. We're monitoring the entire financial system now, you know, in this post-crisis era. You know, probably will end up with teams or very organized efforts to, you know, monitor what's happening in hedge funds, venture capital, private equity, other sectors of the economy that are outside the banking system. But I was certainly getting some information from my contacts who were directors, advisory council members, or other business contacts I had. So there was some information that was there, and it did inform. You know, was it late in the process, too close to the crisis to have, you know, made a difference? You know, probably, but certainly I was picking up signals from my contacts.
Well, I mean, you say that now that there's a focus on financial stability, hopefully that'll improve. But technically, it has always been the mandate of the Fed Board of Governors to look at stability of the financial system. It's right there in a huge paragraph, right in the front page of the document on the rules and functions of the Fed.
Do you want me to answer that question?
I would love to.
So, financial stability is one of the things mentioned in the preamble to the Federal Reserve Act, but there's no authorities given to the board to actually carry that out. That's one of the points of Dodd-Frank and the expansion of authority and point of view that Dodd-Frank tries. I think the best way to read that, and if you go back to the very beginning and where that paragraph came from, the best way to read that is that was the mandate to the FOMC in setting monetary policy to take into account financial stability, and also the board reserve bank's role is lender of last resort. But in the supervisory function, it's actually exactly as the vice chairman has explained. Graham Leach Bliley, the Bank Holding Company Act, all the supervisory authorities given to us are all focused on the safety and soundness of the insured depository institution. Our authorities to examine, our authorities to take enforcement action, everything is focused on that, not on financial stability in the way that now Dodd-Frank allows us to do.
So. Okay, but even so, you have the language in the preamble. It does exist, and I understand it's not part of the supervisory function that you would have had in San Francisco, but it is a function of folks in Washington, and you're now one of them. You know, so what's your assessment of that function, which did exist at least in the preamble through this period?
Preamble is the overture.
Thank you, Tom.
I have one last question.
I'm sorry, Tom, but could we just give a chance to answer?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
I think we had a less organized effort than I hope we will have going forward. I agree with Scott's answer. I don't think it was a core responsibility with which we were charged, and I don't think we... I mean, it of course played some role in thinking about appropriate monetary policy, and to that extent, it's not as though we gave no attention to it. We did give attention to it because it does have a bearing on monetary policy. It wasn't directly our supervisory role. And I would just say we did not have a sufficiently focused and organized effort in the way we would if, you know, the Federal Reserve Act says we should achieve maximum employment and price stability. Explicit charge, we call it our dual mandate. Doesn't say and monitor and take action to ensure price financial stability. If it had been a triple mandate, we probably would have a division of financial stability. We would be, you know, assessing it, reporting on it. And as I say, to his credit, Chairman Bernanke, when he was appointed, really felt this was something we ought to do, we should ramp up to do. And I think he did more than it, you know, was in the process of doing more now. It was too late, it wasn't sufficient, but I think the chairman really was focused on this is something we ought to take more seriously and focus more energy on. We certainly could have. There was nothing, to my knowledge, preventing us from investing more energy and resources in doing this, but I don't think we were.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights. I think we could go on for quite a while, but thanks.
Quite an exciting and interesting job you folks
have. It is wonderful.
You're enjoying this a little bit?
Well, actually, I call it mind expanding, and then I talked to a friend and I said mind expending, so I'm afraid that was a Freudian slip, but thank you. It's really been fascinating, and you've shared a lot of really great insights, and thank you
very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck. Look forward to reading your report.
So do we.